Batch a Batch. Night gathers, and now our podcast begins. It shall not end until we're done talking. We are
the princes that were promised.
Welcome to the princes that were promised. It's me, it's Shawnee Wan, and with me today, my co-host, Sir Barristan the Bold, my chinchilla. John again is unfortunately not with me. It's just a tough week is what it boils down to. John had his Guns N' Roses concert this past weekend. I was transferred to a new location and my schedule is all out of whack because I am going on a family vacation this coming weekend, but I will be home in time for episode 6, Death is the Enemy. I already watched it. And it's not illegal. Well, I guess it is illegal, but this wasn't a hack or a leak, and I don't condone hacks or leaks. I had the opportunity to watch The Spoils of War when it was leaked, like, what did those guys do? They leaked it like 12 hours before the episode aired. Okay. Ended up being the highest rated Game of Thrones episode of all time. And I had the option to watch it, and I almost watched it, but I don't condone hacks or leaks. This is different. This was aired in Spain. It was an accident on HBO's part. So the way I justify it is I pretend that I have a friend in Spain who DVR'd Death is the Enemy, and we watched it together, Google Hangouts or Skype or something. And I'm not going to talk about Death is the Enemy. I'm just telling you, I saw it, and you know that John saw it. And we will talk about that on Sunday and have it for you on Monday. And we have a lot to talk about with Death is the Enemy. Today I'm talking about Eastwatch, the Seven-Pointed Star, 5th edition. And with no one to banter with, I'm just going to dive right into it. Narrative justice, number one. I've been talking about this all season. Every week I say, I've been talking about this all season. And then I talk about it some more. And I'm going to try and talk it to death right now. And please excuse the construction that's going on at my house. Just another thing about this week that makes it very difficult to get podcasts out. But we persevere. The reason I started talking about narrative justice in the first place... Right. Okay, that's great. Is because of a group text that I'm on with John. With my two brothers, Daniel and Patrick, Uncle Pip, to fans of the show. And my best friend, Brian. And these guys are huge marks for Daenerys Targaryen, especially Brian. Brian is confident that he knows the ending of Game of Thrones. He's confident that Jon Snow is going to die. Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot. He's confident that Jon Snow is going to die. And my brother Daniel jumps on board with him and says he's confident that Jon Snow is going to die also. And they say that there's many context clues within the narrative of the TV show that say that Jon Snow is going to die. Jon starts to argue that they're just wrong. And I say, you guys are right. He already died, though. He died already. And they say, no, he's going to die for real because he doesn't want to be king. And maybe they're right. I don't know. I don't know how this ends. John doesn't know how this ends. But it got me thinking about narrative justice. Despite the shocks, despite the Red Weddings, the Baelors, despite all of these deaths of major characters that come out of left field that surprise us in Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire, there are still rules to this narrative. There's rules to this world and to this story being told. And these rules aren't so much rules of the narrative as they are moral rules, right and wrong, for the characters within. And the easiest example I can give you, which is kind of a no-brainer, Ramsay Snow, Ramsay Bolton, being eaten alive by his dogs, the dogs he used to kill so many people to hunt down women, he gets eaten by them. He's their master, he fed them, he took care of them, they were his girls, and he dies being eaten by what he loved the most. Well, a guy like Ramsay Snow is not capable of love, you know what I mean. Sansa doesn't let her half-brother kill him, and instead puts him in a dungeon and lets these dogs out, which is also justice because, well, Sansa was his wife who he raped and beat, even though I hate that part of the storyline. Her being the character that dispenses of this justice is part of the justice itself. That's an easy example. We're not here to talk about easy examples. I can come up with a billion examples, but I'm only going to talk about three. Which characters alive. Still part of the Game of Thrones narrative. Which characters have committed heinous or unforgivable acts and have yet to receive their due narrative justice? What is narrative justice? Is this something that Shawnee Wan made up? It might be. I feel like I've heard the term before, but the way I describe narrative justice is rules pertaining to whatever story you're reading or watching or listening to, and characters that break those rules receive justice either deus ex machina or from a protagonist or from a character functioning as a moral compass or from a character that they committed a heinous or unforgivable act against. So the best example is Ramsay Snow, Sansa Stark. She feeds him to his dogs. That's too easy. Theon Greyjoy, Jaime Lannister. This is a little bit more difficult. Jaime pushed a child out a window and he lost his hand. Was he deserving of losing his hand? Does losing his hand, is that justice for him pushing a boy out the window? When I read A Song of Ice and Fire, when I read A Storm of Swords and it happened, I thought, yes, it is. Because so much of who he was his fighting hand. But that's not really the direction they go in with Jaime in HBO's adaptation, is it? He seems to be fighting just as well with his left hand. So did Jaime really receive his due narrative justice for pushing Bran out the window? This is probably the most complex case because if Bran wasn't pushed out the window, if Bran wasn't in a coma, if Bran didn't lose the use of his legs, would Bran have heard the calling from the Three-Eyed Raven? Would Bran have traveled north of the Wall? Would the whole War of the Five Kings have started? Possibly not. Both sides were ready to explode, Stark and Lannister, and Ned traveling south to King's Landing. I'm sure something would have happened. John and I did our War of the Five Kings series way back when, and you can find it in our archives. We went through each king. King Rob, King Balon, King Stannis, King Renly, King Joffrey. A little bit of their background and the lead up to their campaign in the War of the Five Kings. When you look at the War of the Five Kings as a whole, a few occurrences set the war off. Bran's attempted murder being one of them. And Bran's attempted murder only happens because Bran is pushed out a window. Although to the Starks, they think that he fell from the tower. Would there have been a realm-wide civil war if Bran wasn't pushed from the window and then almost killed by an assassin? Probably. Who knows? But that's the story. Jaime didn't do what he did for the betterment of Bran Stark. He did it to protect himself and Cersei and their children. Could they have kept Bran quiet? Possibly. Who knows? I have a 7-year-old and you can never keep him quiet. Hell, he'll even say, can we watch this scary movie? I promise I won't tell mom. And I'll say, no, you're going to tell mom. And he says, no, I promise I won't tell mom. I said, listen, if you want to watch it that badly and you're not going to tell mom, I'm not going to say that I approve, but if you want to watch it, go right ahead. Just don't tell mom. And as soon as mom comes home, the first thing that my 7-year-old stepson says is, Sean, let me watch The Walking Dead, or Sean, let me watch Night of the Living Dead, or whatever it is. And then Shawnee Wan's in trouble. So 7-year-olds can't keep quiet. I don't think Jaime has enough parenting experience to know that, but he's not going to risk his life, Cersei's life, the honor of House Lannister on the life of a 7-year-old. Is it narrative justice that he just lost a hand for attempting to kill a child? Maybe it is. Maybe it is. I'm going to say yes. Jaime losing his sword hand is justice for the crime he commits. Had Bran died, would it be justice? That's the question. Probably not. Probably not. So then narrative justice is conditional upon the results of the decision or the action that the character makes. And Jaime had every intention of killing Bran. So even though Bran lived, shouldn't Jaime be on the receiving end of a crueler justice? And he may still be due some narrative justice. This may be the reason that Jaime doesn't live to see the end of this series. But there's another factor at play here. Bran didn't die, though Jaime had every intention of killing him. Jaime pays for what happened to Bran, even though what happened wasn't his intent, by losing his sword hand, which is the part of him that really defined who he was. Jaime's character seems to change after he loses his sword hand, and for a while it seems to make him a better person, a more righteous character, more of a protagonist than an antagonist. And John brought this up first, that he seems to slip back and forth. When he's around Cersei, he is more like Cersei and less like the Jaime that he was becoming. I'm confident by the end of this series, he will have abandoned Cersei to join the good fight. And that wouldn't have happened if he hadn't received his justice for the crime that he committed. So again, I do think that Jaime received the narrative justice that he was due. Theon Greyjoy is another character who we didn't see in Eastwatch. And it's kind of odd now that I've been thinking about it, that we didn't see him in Eastwatch because he was at Dragonstone last episode. Where did he go? Maybe he went to try and save his sister. I guess we'll find out. But Theon Greyjoy, called a kinslayer for killing the children of his warden, I guess is the best word. He was ward to Eddard Stark. Eddard Stark was his surrogate father, in a sense. In truth, he was a hostage for his own father's, his real father's, Balon Greyjoy's, good behavior. But he was still raised by Ned, by Eddard Stark, along with his children. In many a sense, those were his brothers, Bran and Rickon. So when he made it appear that he killed them both, not only does he betray his warden, his family, but he kills his brothers, kids that grew up around him. But he didn't, really. Theon is captured by the Boltons and tortured mentally and physically, emotionally. His life is forever changed, and he'll never be the same man that he was. Cocky, arrogant young lordling that he was. He becomes reek. He becomes a servant, constantly, physically, mentally, sexually abused by Ramsay Snow. And he tries to make up for what he did by saving Sansa, risking his life to save Sansa. And he didn't really kill Bran and Rickon. So all of the abuse at the hands of Ramsay Snow, the harm's way that he put himself in by saving Sansa, and of course, losing his nuts and his dick, the whole package. He got the whole package cut off. Is that justice enough for what he did, considering that he didn't kill these boys? He just made it seem like he killed these boys. Well, it's not, because even though he didn't really kill Bran and Rickon, he did kill two boys. He killed the Miller's boys. Small folk, yeah, but children, nonetheless. And he killed them, and he burnt the bodies, and he made it appear like they were his foster brothers. Not foster brothers, that's not the right word. I'm not sure what the word is I'm looking for. But his surrogate family. Theon's probably gone through the most difficult time of any character in Game of Thrones, without a doubt. But the premeditated act, the planning, using the corpses of two young boys, I don't know if that's justice enough. I think justice is Theon's life. And I think it's an honorable and fairly painless death if he continues to redeem himself. Cool. They're listening to music. So that's pretty cool. So no, I don't think Theon's received his justice yet. And Theon is one of my favorite characters, without a doubt. But I don't think he's received his narrative justice yet. I think he received the more difficult part of it, but he does have a death sentence hanging over him. And that manner of death really depends on how he handles what he has left to give to this narrative. There's other characters, lots of other characters. Cersei Lannister, but that's kind of a no-brainer. No, she hasn't received justice yet. That walk of shame was not her receiving justice. That was her using that option to get out of the Sept of Baelor and to get back to her son. The things that she's done are probably worse than anyone else in this narrative. Maybe not Ramsay Bolton. She killed a lot of people, like a lot of people. And her justice is coming. And she's not going to live to see the end of this. She can't. And her death is going to be a horrible thing. It has to be. Tyrion Lannister? He killed his father. Unless it works out that that's not his father and he is a secret Targaryen.
Secret Targaryen.
Secret Targaryen.
If Tyrion's a secret Targaryen, then he's not a kinslayer and he didn't kill his father. Patricide, I believe they call it. But if that is his father, even though his father's the worst to him, mentally abusive, sexually abusive in A Song of Ice and Fire, and no, he didn't molest Tyrion. He made Lannister men-at-arms rape Tyrion's wife. So Tywin was deserving of that fate, but kinslaying in this narrative is a punishable offense. So Tyrion may very well be on the receiving end of narrative justice. Now, I don't think so because he's done a lot of good, and this was a breaking point for him with his father, and his father would have executed him. So it's tricky. Arya Stark, she's killed a lot of people too. There was that scene in episode 1 of season 7 on Dragonstone where she comes across Ed Sheeran and all of his friends, all Lannister men at arms. And I'm not so sure that she didn't kill them. I'm not so sure. And if she did, those are the kind of actions that deserve narrative justice. Sansa Stark, she, I think, received her narrative justice for the things she did. Perhaps you can argue that she cost her father his life, but she's been raped, married to people she doesn't want to be married to, beaten, abused. Littlefinger, that's a no-brainer. He's got justice coming his way. Bronn of the Blackwater, Sandor Clegane, Melisandre of Al-Shaai, Ser Jorah Mormont. Probably not Ser Jorah Mormont. He betrayed Dany. He made up for it. He had grayscale. I think he served his narrative justice. But Bronn of the Blackwater, Sandor Clegane, Melisandre of Al-Shaai, all of these characters have committed horrible acts. Sandor, granted, he did it in the name of his prince and king, but there's repercussions for these actions. I'm not going to go in depth about them. I want to talk about Dany before I wrap this up. And Dany is the reason I've been preaching this so much the last few weeks. The decision she made in the Spoils of War to burn those Lannister men. And in Eastwatch, to burn the Tarleys. The argument being, to make an egg, you gotta break some omelets. She led a noble house of Westeros to extinction because they wouldn't bend the knee to her. An invading queen, mind you. That can be viewed as evil, as a heinous act. It can be. And I imagine she's going to do more and more of this. It could be just growing pains as a queen, learning what is right and what is not right to do here in Westeros, which is different than Meereen, different than the free cities that she had already conquered. But I would go as far as to say she will receive narrative justice. I've said it before. And maybe it does tie into Jon's theory that she is Nissa Nissa. We're just going to have to wait and find out. But you need to look at these acts that she commits. It's one thing to destroy Cersei. It's another thing to burn not even Cersei's army. It's a Lannister army. Conscription is how this army is formed. These guys don't sign up to be in the army. They're not getting a fucking GI bill. They're not volunteers. They have no choice but to fight. And that's how it works. And she burns them. And technically, the war had not started yet. The Martells, the Tyrells, they were traitors to the crown. That wasn't an opening attack against Daenerys. I guess you could view it as though it was. It's tricky. It's right there. It's in that shade of gray. And it's on a knife's edge. You could go one way or another. And I think that it skews to a heinous act, with Daenerys Targaryen being deserving of narrative justice. Thoughts, comments, hit us up. Let me know. Seven-pointed star. Rhaegar plus Lyanna equals Jon. Game of Thrones. V. A Song of Ice and Fire. It's not quite a throwaway line from Gilly. It's just a mispronouncing of Prince Rhaegar's name to Prince Rhaegar. And Sam being so consumed by his frustration and anger at the Maesters that he doesn't pick up on what she said. He just wasn't listening to what she said. And I understand that. There's many times that I don't listen to people, especially when I'm in my own head and trying to figure my own things out. But it seems the way that Benioff and Weiss are going is that Rhaegar had his marriage to Ilya Martell of Dorne annulled so that he could marry Lyanna. Unless Prince Rhaegar is somebody besides Prince Rhaegar, that's exactly what happened. His marriage with Ilya was annulled and he had a secret wedding to Lyanna Stark, ergo making Jon Snow Jon Targaryen, or whatever his real name is, Targaryen, and heir to the realm. Because an annulment, I don't know how that works in Westeros. I don't know if that keeps rights to his children with Ilya, but it matters little because they're both dead in Game of Thrones, along with Ilya, along with himself, and along with Lyanna. Really, the only one left is Jon Snow Targaryen, whatever his first name is. And he has a better claim than Dany, especially, well, basically only if they were married. Is George R.R. Martin going to go the route of an annulment? I don't think so, and Jon doesn't think so. Targaryens can take multiple wives. And I think he thinks that's what will happen in A Song of Ice and Fire. The reason they don't do that in Game of Thrones is because it's little things like that that take away from a character that we're supposed to like, that we're supposed to view as a good guy, as a protagonist. In this case, Rhaegar. Rhaegar having multiple wives, that's not really a likable characteristic of a character. And it also leads to the question, are Benioff and Weiss going a little bit too easy on some characters in order to make them more likable? Tyrion, going back to Tyrion, is another good example. They take it a little bit easy on his character. His character was much more of a douchebag in A Dance with Dragons. But in Season 5, he was just committed to Daenerys Targaryen. Whereas in the material that Season 5 was adapted from, he wasn't so sure about Daenerys Targaryen. He wasn't so sure about young Griff, Jon Connington, even Varys, Illyrio Mopatis, all these people that he came in contact with who were trying to lead him to Aegon Targaryen and then Daenerys Targaryen. He wasn't so sure, and he tested them a little bit to see if they were worthy rulers. And he slept with more whores, and he got ridiculously drunk. He wasn't as identifiable a character. He had a much darker tone to him. Benioff and Weiss did away with that, and it could be argued easily that they did this because of time constraints. But it was also to make Tyrion look better. Jaime Lannister, speaking of Tyrion's first wife, I mentioned it before when I was talking about narrative justice, but Tyrion had a wife that was sent away by his lord father after his men-at-arms raped her. And in A Song of Ice and Fire, Jaime tells Tyrion that the girl was a woman that he hired and paid to be with Tyrion. And then he reveals that that was a lie when he frees Tyrion from the black cells. Tyrion says, the next time we meet, we will meet as enemies. Also with Jaime, when Roose Bolton gives Robb Stark the death blow at the Red Wedding, he doesn't say the Lannisters send their regards. He says, Jaime Lannister sends his regards. And it's little things like this, again, that make a character that we're supposed to start to like, or supposed to like, supposed to view as a good guy, as a protagonist, it makes them less so. It makes them more shade of gray, skewing towards an antagonist, a bad guy. So Rhaegar and Lyanna equals Jon Snow, I think, is going to be a lot more clear-cut in Game of Thrones. Just some written words, some written history, and maybe Hallen Reed showing up to confirm. Whereas in A Song of Ice and Fire, it's going to be a little bit more difficult, especially with the inclusion of Aegon Targaryen and with Rhaegar having multiple wives. It's going to be a little bit more difficult for Jon Snow to be who he is. But he is going to be that person nonetheless. Number 3. Jon and Shani Wan are the princes that were promised, but who is the prince that was promised? And I really wish I had Jon here for this one. I'll revisit it with him. We've talked about it before. Are the prince that was promised and Azor Ahai one and the same person? I think for Game of Thrones, most definitely. For Song of Ice and Fire, maybe not. But this is the Seven-Pointed Star, Edition 5, based on Eastwatch. So the answer is yes. If there is a prince that was promised and an Azor Ahai, well, there's written accounts of Azor Ahai. But if there is a prince that was promised and Azor Ahai is reborn, they are one in the same person. Jon and I, well, and a lot of people, assume that Jon Snow is the prince that was promised. And it's based on the context clues in George's writing and our viewing of Game of Thrones. And this has nothing to do with him being a Targaryen. This is just, is he Azor Ahai reborn? Is he the last hero? Most likely. But let's pretend for a moment that we're dismissing all these context clues. Who then are the leading candidates to be Azor Ahai, the prince that was promised, the last hero? Jon Snow, obviously. Daenerys Targaryen, born amidst salt and smoke. Yeah, Drogo's funeral pyre. Beneath a bleeding star. Yeah, the meteor. That fits. But it's a little bit too obvious. A little bit too on the nose. And all these people that say, well, Jon isn't the son of Rhaegar and Lyanna because it's too obvious. And George doesn't do things that are obvious. Okay, I agree. He doesn't do things that are obvious. But Daenerys Targaryen is a bit obvious, don't you think? So she's a red herring. She's not Azor Ahai. She's not the prince that was promised. She's just Daenerys Targaryen. The last scion of the great Valyrian house. Targaryen. Sandor Clegane was an earlier favorite to be Azor Ahai, born amidst salt and smoke. A lot of people say that were supporters of the Sandor Clegane as Azor Ahai theory, that this is a reference to the Battle of the Blackwater. Comet, salt, Blackwater Rush, smoke, wildfire. But he doesn't really change that much. So then you got to think, maybe when he's almost killed by Brienne. But where's the salt and smoke? Where's the bleeding sky? Not likely for Sandor Clegane. Davos Seaworth, same kind of thing with the Battle of the Blackwater. Born amidst salt and smoke, he went overboard. He washes up on some tiny island and he gets found. That's it. Nothing happens from there. He doesn't change all that much. He's still Davos Flea Bottom. So no. Tyrion Lannister, no way. Beric Dondarrion. No. He's risen again, but he's not the last hero. He dies too many times. So it really leaves two characters that could be taken seriously. And one of them, I mentioned because of what happened to him at the end of the Spoils of War. Jaime Lannister, born amidst salt and smoke beneath a bleeding star. And I was wrong in my instant review of Eastwatch. That wasn't the Mander River. That was the Blackwater. So salt and smoke, salt of the Blackwater, which comes from Blackwater Bay, which comes from the Narrow Sea, which has salt in the water. It's seawater. Smoke, burning bodies, burning horses, burning carriages, lots of smoke, and a bleeding star. Was there a bleeding star at the Loot Train attack? The Loot Train battle? I don't fucking know. I don't think so. Drogon was bleeding. They say dragons are living fire. Stars are, well, a lot of gas, right? I'm not sure what makes up a star, but they're hot, like a dragon. Maybe. I don't know if that fits, the bleeding star part. Maybe we could make something work. Hammer it in, make it fit. It's possible. It's very possible for Jaime to be Azor Ahai, the prince that was promised. But it all goes back to Jon Snow, and it makes the most sense. When he's betrayed by the Night's Watch in A Dance with Dragons, 1-1 is kicking the crap out of Sir Patrick of King's Mountain, a queen's man, and his sigil is a star. And 1-1 is slamming him against, against the wall or against rocks, or what is he slamming him against? I don't recall, but he slammed him into a bloody pulp, just tossing him around like a rag doll. So that's the bleeding star. Bowen Marsh is crying as he stabs Jon. That's the salt. His wound is smoking, and he dies. And it seems that that makes the most sense. That Jon is Azor Ahai, the prince that was promised. Case could be made for Daenerys. Case could be made for Jaime Lannister. Maybe a case could be made for Sandor Clegane. But it's got to be Jon. Topic 4, Gendry of King's Landing. And the bastard name for bastards born in the Crownlands is Waters. So technically he's Gendry Waters. And Gendry returns to get, I don't know what the fuck they're doing. Like it sounds like they're vacuuming, which is fine, but it also sounds like they're sanding the floor at the same time. They're vacuuming and sanding the floor. So it's not podcast week. If anything, this is a week to take off from podcasts, but I persevere. Is Gendry returning to Game of Thrones, a Benioff and Weiss original? Or is this a storyline that we'll see Gendry in A Song of Ice and Fire? I don't know. I really think it's just a Benioff and Weiss original. And I don't think that we'll see him, if we do, definitely not to this effect, in A Song of Ice and Fire. Feast for Crows, we last see Gendry at the inn at the crossroads, and it seems that he was abandoned by the Brotherhood Without Banners. There was no storyline where he was sold to Melisandre. The new Brotherhood Without Banners in A Feast for Crows is led by Lady Stoneheart. Lord Beric gave his last life to her, and Lord Beric is gone from the narrative. Eastwatch saw the reintroduction of Joe Dempsey as Gendry, a role which he portrayed in the first, second, and third season. Dempsey was excited to rejoin the cast. He said, "In the intervening 3 years, I would always welcome the opportunity to come back to the show with open arms. I have so many friends on the show, such a great time making it, blah, 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 blah." Dempsey revealed that Benioff and Weiss were unsure when he would return to the show. They told him, "Look, your character is going to disappear for a while. We don't want you to panic. We're not trying to sack you. We like your performance and your character, and we have plans for him further down the line." Some of the storyline that he has already taken is that of Edric Storm, another bastard of Robert Baratheon. And Edric was conceived by Robert Baratheon and Delina of the House Florent on the wedding night of Robert's brother and my boy, Stannis Baratheon, to Selyse Florent. Stannis saw this as an insult to his honor, and he sent Edric to Storm's End to foster with his gay uncle Renly. Delina was a noble woman, so Edric had to be acknowledged by Robert. He was raised in comfort at Storm's End under the guardianship of Sir Courtney Penrose, who was Renly's castellan. Edric's educated by maesters, masters at arms. He was sent a gift from his father every year on his name day. And Stannis intends to use Edric's appearance as proof that Cersei Lannister's children were fathered by her brother in that infamous letter that he sent. In A Song of Ice and Fire, during the Siege of Storm's End, after the death of Renly Baratheon, Stannis offers to let the garrison of Storm's End go free if they surrender Edric Storm to him. But Sir Courtney Penrose, the castellan, won't do it, because he fears that Stannis may burn Edric. Another shadow baby kills Courtney Penrose. Stannis takes the castle and ships Edric and Melisandre to Dragonstone. In A Storm of Swords, Edric has become close with Shireen Baratheon. He refuses to convert to the worship of Valor, and Melisandre keeps pressuring Stannis to burn Edric. Sacrificing his royal blood would wake dragons from stone to help Stannis. Ser Davos pressures Stannis to spare him. Edric is leeched, not Gendry. Edric is leeched, and his blood is used in a curse ritual to harm the three rival kings, Joffrey Baratheon, Balon Greyjoy, and Robb Stark. When all three kings die, Stannis begins to think that there's maybe something to this royal blood idea. But Davos, with the help of Maester Pylos and a small group of kingsmen, have Edric shipped away to the Free Cities. Andrew Estermont, Edric's cousin, will act as his guardian. Gerald Gower, Tristan of Tally Hill, Louis the Fishwife, and Omer Blackberry, none of them appeared in Game of Thrones, obviously, accompany Edric as his guards and protectors. Davos defends his actions to Stannis and convinces Stannis to sail north to aid the Night's Watch. Edric is hiding in Lyse with his guardian and protectors as of a dance with dragons, so they combined elements. I understand why they did it. There's no time for Edric Storm. But is what Gendry's doing in Season 7 a plotline that we'll see for himself or for Edric in A Song of Ice and Fire proper? I don't think so. I don't. Keep in mind, Stannis is still alive in A Song of Ice and Fire. So this is a Benioff and Weiss original. I like it. I love that he has the Warhammer. And I'm glad that it's not going to happen in A Song of Ice and Fire, because it wouldn't make sense there. The books are too committed to realism. Like, where did Gendry learn how to fight with the Warhammer? Why doesn't he want to use his father's name to get himself a better station in life? I don't know. Number 5. How is the Army of the Dead getting through the wall at Eastwatch by the Sea? Is the wall just going to topple over? I mean, if it could, don't you think it would have already? The wall's been up for so long. If the others, the White Walkers, could just topple the wall, what the fuck? Why was it built? But the wall falling, it'd be an awesome visual. Plus, it functions on a narrative sense for the wildlings, the free folk, even though most of them are south of the wall at this point. But that doesn't answer the question. How is the Army of the Dead getting through the wall at Eastwatch by the Sea? In A Dance with Dragons, the commander of Eastwatch is Cotter Pike, a bastard from the island of Pike in the Iron Islands. His ships are attacked, and it's believed that he and his men are dead. But he writes to John, speaking of dead things in the water. So maybe they swim around. This is their entire force. The Night King is leading them. The popular opinion at the end of last season was that Bran allows him through the wall because they can follow Bran anywhere. Maybe it's Jon Snow's recon mission that allows him through the wall. I think it's none of the above. Well, no. Part Bran, but also another reason that I haven't thought of yet, is what gets them through the wall. And do we see that this season? Yeah, I think so. I think that might be like the last scene of this season. Number 6 of the Seven Pointed Star Edition 5. A little bit of a character study on Littlefinger. Is Littlefinger's master plan still the same? Marry Sansa Stark and sit the Iron Throne himself. Arya seems to worry him the most at this point. Sowing discord between her and Sansa, he thinks will lead Sansa into his arms, metaphorically and then literally. So if he creates enemies out of the sisters, it will be good for him, because it seems like he's on the outside looking in right now. And this seems like less of a Hail Mary than giving Bran the cat's paw dagger, which I just didn't follow what his thinking was there. But we get a look at what Littlefinger has done so far in Game of Thrones, and I'm going to try and go through this real quick. As far as I know, his master plan begins by him convincing the Lady Lysa Arryn, his childhood friend, that he loved her, and that she should murder her husband, who also happens to be the King's Hand and the Lord of the Vale, Jon Arryn. She can murder him so they can be together, her and Littlefinger. And this will also make Robert weaker. It will also force him to ask Eddard Stark from Winterfell to come south and serve his hand and set up a showdown between the Starks and the Lannisters. A lot of ifs. But that is how the things break. That's how the story breaks. His next move was to sow discord between Stark and Lannister by telling Kat, his childhood friend and his true love, that the cat's paw dagger used as an attempt on Bran's life belonged to Tyrion Lannister, thus starting the War of the Five Kings. Now, this was not something that he had planned. This was him improvising. It was lucky for him that Jaime pushed Bran out the window and that Joffrey tried to have Bran killed. But it's possible that that was at Littlefinger's behest. Peter Baelish gained Eddard's trust, well, a fraction of Eddard's trust, by telling Eddard that he couldn't trust him, as in Littlefinger, though confirming what Ned already believed. And then he came through for Eddard in very minor ways to confirm Ned's suspicion that yes, he is trustworthy and without much honor, but he would never do anything to harm Kat and therefore can be trusted to help Kat. I'm not going to say it's genius, but it's a pretty smart move on Littlefinger's part. Pretty smart way to gain trust of a person who trusts very few people. With Robert on his deathbed, Littlefinger tries to convince Ned, who was named Protector of the Realm by Robert on his deathbed, to side with Cersei, to remain in the game. Together they'll try and control Joffrey, and if he is uncontrollable, they can always reveal Joffrey's bastardy and then seat Renly on the Iron Throne. So this is when Ned comes to Littlefinger and reveals that Joffrey is a bastard born of incest, and Littlefinger seems like he already knew that. And I don't think Littlefinger ever believed that Ned would side with him, but he makes the overture anyway. He then betrays Ned to remain with the winning side when he confirms that Ned won't do anything unhonorable and therefore can't play this Game of Thrones. In Game of Thrones, he helps to unite Lannister and Tyrell. This makes himself seem loyal, indispensable, and he's also rewarded with Harrenhal and all of its lands and incomes. And as Lord of Harrenhal, he's also named Lord Paramount of the Riverlands. And both these titles give him the ability to marry the Widow Arryn, his old childhood friend Lysa, who was ruling at the Vale. He then seeks out and pays Ser Dantas Hollard to assist in saving Sansa Stark. And I should know this. I'm embarrassed that I don't, but I know that it's true in A Song of Ice and Fire. He helps conspire with Lady Olenna Tyrell to poison Joffrey Baratheon. This does a few things for him. It allows Sansa to escape from King's Landing. It strengthens the alliance he has with the Tyrells without weakening the one he has with the Lannisters. It removes Tyrion, somebody who seems to have been figured out, from the equation, because he is charged with the murder. He saves Sansa, he assassinates Dantas Hollard to tie up loose ends, and he ushers her away to the Vale, but I believe it might be the Fingers in Game of Thrones. But here, he marries Lysa Arryn, well aware that she's crazy. But by marrying her, he now has access to ruling the Vale of Arryn through her. He then uses Sansa to make Lysa Arryn jealous, because he knows that it will make her act really crazy. He then murders Lysa Arryn with Sansa as a witness. Lysa was attacking Sansa, and Sansa was fearing for her life. Lysa's death gives Littlefinger the title Protector of the Vale, Lord of Harrenhal, Lord Paramount of the Riverlands, all without winning a war, all without setting foot inside the Castle Harrenhal. It gives him control of the Knights of the Vale and the armies of the Vale, which sat out the War of the Five Kings and are fresh. In Game of Thrones, he then plans a wedding pact with Lord Roose Bolton, the new Warden of the North. Sansa will marry his son Ramsay. So one way or another, this will lead Littlefinger to have great influence in the North as well. But this is the point in which it seems that Littlefinger loses a lot of the control that he had over his master plan, and he has to trust in the pieces that he put into play. Ramsay turns out to be a lot crazier than he anticipated, and that nearly turns Sansa against him completely. It seemed Littlefinger expected Stannis to win Winterfell and to allow Sansa to take control of Winterfell as the lady in Winterfell. From there, he could join the Vale to Stannis' cause to defeat Tommen, but more likely, he would feign an alliance with Stannis and betray him as a favor to Cersei. Somehow explain that to Sansa and use Sansa as a ruse to return to Cersei's good graces, then betray Cersei, possibly using his alliance with Lady Olenna, ditch Sansa maybe, marry Margaery, and voila, King Littlefinger. But that calls into question whether he truly loves Sansa or not. I don't think he's capable of love at all. That's a very possible endgame that he had in mind. But Stannis doesn't win the Battle of Winterfell. So again, Littlefinger has to improvise. He uses the Vale to assist Sansa and Jon Snow in retaking Winterfell. So it's dumb luck that Sansa was able to escape the Boltons. I'm sure he had a plan for if she didn't, as he already had an alliance with the Boltons. He uses the Vale to help them, and I think he assumed that Sansa would be named the Lady of Winterfell, but she is not. Jon Snow is named King in the North, and worse yet, Sansa still doesn't trust him, despite him saving her, despite him helping her win back Winterfell. Now Littlefinger has to improvise again, by beginning to sow discord between Jon Snow and Sansa. And maybe it's a stroke of luck for Littlefinger that Jon Snow travels south. It gives him the time and the space to return to Sansa's good graces. But while he's doing that, Bran and then Arya both return to Winterfell. He tries to work Bran with no luck, because Bran's creepy as hell. He doesn't even try to work Arya, and he sees her as a huge problem. So now, what's Littlefinger's plan? So discord between Sansa and Arya, somehow remove Arya from the equation, convince Sansa that Cersei is a dangerous enemy and they must march on her. Boom. King Littlefinger. He believes Sansa will be driven back to him for advice and protection. And so far, he seems he might be right. This is a long, drawn-out plan on Littlefinger's end. While I admire the improvisation planning, it's not going to work out, obviously. I don't think Season 8 will see Peter Baelish among the living. The Seven-Pointed Star. Observation number 7. Study of a scene. Tyrion's return to King's Landing. And it's this scene that is really the heart of the Eastwatch episode, as Tyrion and Davos both return to King's Landing. The setup is that Tyrion needs to speak to Jaime and try to convince Jaime to convince Cersei to have an audience with Daenerys to discuss the army of the dead that Jon Snow is telling them about. Yowzers. If I was Jaime and Tyrion came to me in secret and said, I had to seek you out and try to convince you to convince Cersei to have an audience with Daenerys to discuss the army of the dead that we don't know if we believe in but Jon Snow is telling us about, I would say, dude, you could have just called. Like, why can't you just say you want to see me? You got to make up this whole big story. This is the heart of the episode. And as it begins, Tyrion and Davos pull their rowboat on a hidden cove. I guess that's what that's called, a cove, right? And immediately their relationship takes a new dynamic as Tyrion learns he killed Davos' son. Tyrion says, the last time I was here, I killed my father. And Davos says, the last time I was here, you killed my son. Tyrion immediately knows what he's talking about, but Davos presses on. What's there to say? Davos says he has his own business, as Tyrion goes to seek out audience with Jaime. Davos has business in Flea Bottom. He's seeking Gendry. So how did he know that Gendry would be there? All he has to go on is that he told Gendry to hide under the queen's nose. And I guess Gendry didn't have that many options, and it seemed like a good idea. Davos was taking a chance. So is this plausible? Yeah, absolutely. Tyrion gets in touch with Bronn somehow. How? Maybe they both had a love for the same whorehouses? The same wine sinks? I can believe that Tyrion was able to get in touch with Bronn. Maybe he sent a raven to him. Who knows? Bronn convinces Jaime that they need to practice in, I don't know what, the basement of the Red Keep? But it's a setup. Tyrion is there. And we get our Tyrion-Jaime reunion. And the first thing of note is Tyrion explaining why he killed Tywin. Jaime's mad at him for that. And Tyrion uses self-pity, saying, it's not my fault I was born like a monster and he hated me for it. And this strikes a nerve with Jaime. He understands this. But it also angers him that his brother is using self-pity. because this was something that they had a very good relationship and it never experienced self-pity on either. Jaime listens to Tyrion explain that his sister is basically fucked and they can't beat Daenerys. Jaime has already come to this conclusion, and hearing Tyrion say it really brings it home. Tyrion tells Jaime that Daenerys doesn't want Cersei to bend the knee quite yet. Instead, Dany wants an audience with Cersei to discuss the White Walkers and the Army of the Dead. And the reunion ends abruptly, like cut scene. This left me wanting, but it also allows fill in the blanks of their reunion in their own words, from their own point of view, based on what they took from the reunion. And it leaves a lingering sense of conflict between the two for when they do meet again. And I learned that Jaime was a lot more angry with Tyrion than I thought he was. Jaime goes to the Red Keep, to Cersei's quarters, to inform Cersei about his meeting with Tyrion, and he walks in on Cersei and Qyburn discussing something that seems devious, something Cersei doesn't and won't tell Jaime about. She does tell Jaime that she knew Bronn had brought Tyrion to the Red Keep, and she also implies that Bronn betrayed Jaime. She says she's open to meeting Daenerys and admit that perhaps they can't beat her in the field. She also implies that she has a devious, Tywin Lannister-like, possibly guest-right betraying plan in mind for Daenerys. Since they can't beat her in the field, they're going to have to beat her Red Wedding style. She also reveals that she's Prego. Cersei Lannister is pregnant. The child is Jaime's. Jaime asks who the father shall be, and she says, you. They will admit their love to the realm. And Cersei seems to be feeling more confident and more comfortable in her grasp on power. There's no mention of marriage, but it's implied that they will marry and rule as the Targaryens did, brother and sister in marriage. As she and Jaime embrace, Cersei says to him, never betray me again. So how did Jaime betray Cersei exactly? What is she referring to? And the only thing I can think of is meeting Tyrion, allowing Tyrion to leave? I'm not sure. It's also mentioned during this meeting that, perhaps it was in the earlier scene, I don't know. But it was also mentioned that Jaime knows Tyrion didn't poison Joffrey. Lady Olenna Tyrell admitted to it as she was dying, and Cersei just doesn't believe it, and she dismisses it out of hand. Davos tracks down Gendry on the Street of Armor. Gendry is working as an armorer. As soon as Davos appears, Gendry is like super happy, and he's ready to go wherever Davos wants him to go. He's no longer interested in being an armorer. And the sickest part is he's got a warhammer. It's not Robert's, but it's still a warhammer. It's sick. Gendry, Davos, and Tyrion make to leave King's Landing. First, Gendry and Davos, and we experience Davos smooth-talking the guards, which impresses Gendry. Tyrion arrives, and he is recognized. They try to talk their way out of it. Gendry realizes they can't, and he smashes both of the guards' heads with his warhammer, and they all leave. It's a hell of a scene, and the reason that it's the heart of this episode is because it sets up everything that it seems either Episode 6 or Episode 7, most likely Episode 7, will be about. A meeting of Westeros about the Army of the Dead. Again, Tyrion is functioning as that go-between, as the character that connects other characters. It's textbook Davos, reintroducing Gendry with more of a Robert Baratheon feel to him. It further pushes, more so than really any episode over the last couple seasons, the Cersei-Jaime relationship. It really pushes it to the brink. Jaime seems like he's letting all of his reservations about Cersei go, and I think that if she does something that he just finds ridiculously heinous or evil or a bad idea, she will assume she has power over Jaime and dismiss whatever he has to say about it, and he will end up abandoning her. And I think we'll see this in Episode 6 or 7. I'm saying like we'll see this in Episode 6. I know if we see it in Episode 6. And I'm not going to say either way, but I did watch Death is the Enemy, so I know what happens, and it's really good. Great acting all around by every single actor involved. Joe Dempsey, Robert Dempsey, Billy Dempsey, Patrick Dempsey. What is fucking Gendry's actor's name? Joe Dempsey. I mean, okay acting by Joe Dempsey. I don't really like his haircut. I'm glad Gendry's back. He was one of those few better on screen than in the book. There's one scene that defines what Eastwatch is about. It's this scene at King's Landing. Tyrion's not-so-triumphant return to King's Landing. And that is what I got for the Seven-Pointed Star. It is an abridged episode this week with no John to bounce any of this off of. It's basically just my opinion and what I think. You can like it, you can not like it. You could hit me up and talk to me about it. You can find The Princes That Were Promised at thepromisedprinces.actionpackpodcasts.com. You can bend the knee and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/thepromisedprinces. You can send us a raven on Twitter at Prince's Promise. You could read our writings and more in-depth reviews, theprincesthatwerepromised.wordpress.com, or you could just find all of the bullshit that I mentioned above in Fleabottom, theprincesthatwerepromised.tumblr.com. Action Packed Productions is now on Instagram under Action Packed Productions. Of course, subscribe to Hell Yeah News on Twitter. Reaction Photo Action on Instagram to check out what Uncle Pip is up to. SummerSlam is coming up this weekend, so shout out to the best professional wrestling podcast I listen to, my good friend Liam the Kid McNulty and Jimmy Moorcraft, Wishful Booking Wrestling. You can find that on Apple Podcasts. You can also find a link to their podcast at thepromisedprinces.actionpackedpodcasts.com. And unfortunately, we have to forego the Lord of Lightning Round for now. I think we'll return to it with our instant review. But thank you for listening. You guys are the best, and we'll speak with you later on.
I watched episode 6 already. Bum, 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 bum,